So we're going back to the patriarchs this morning. I've talked on some other things since the last time that I shared, but we're going to be talking about Jacob and Laban and Jacob's trip and some things like that. But before we start, let's have the children come forward. I don't know, maybe there's enough space over here on my right. If not, we can go over to the other side. Okay, we have just enough seats for everyone. Good morning. So, we are going to talk about a wedding this morning. How many of you all like to go to weddings? Okay, there's two of you, three. I will tell you a big secret. I don't like going to weddings very much. Yes, Elise? Because you get married. So my favorite wedding was the one where I married your mom. And they've all gone downhill since then. I don't know. So what's your favorite part of weddings? Yes, Grayson. Meeting all your cousins. So what if you went to a wedding where there weren't any cousins there? Usually there are. You just have to make sure they're invited, right? Elise, what's your favorite part of weddings? The dessert, that's definitely the best part. I think we can all agree that the best part of a wedding is the dessert. So when I was a boy, I went to an awful lot of weddings, it seemed like. And do you know what kind of food they had at those weddings? They had hot ham and cheese sandwiches. That seemed to be the thing. That was back in the early 90s. I guess there was a real deal on ham and cheese then. Maybe it was easy too, I'm not sure. And they often had cake and ice cream. Does that sound tasty? Yeah, it does. So I was looking it up because weddings can be expensive. We were talking about this the other day, but they don't have to be expensive. But sometimes people spend way too much money on them. So back in 1981, there was a man whose name was Prince Charles. Have any of you all heard of Prince Charles? No. Grayson may have heard of him. Yeah. He's actually named King Charles now. Do you think he changed his name? Yeah, probably. I think other people changed it for him. So Prince and King actually weren't his first name. His first name was Charles, and Prince was a title. So Prince Charles is now the King of England. So that's pretty important, isn't it? So he got married to a lady named Princess Diana. And their wedding, if you would calculate in today's money, would have cost $48 million. Does that sound like a lot of money? Yeah, that's a lot of money. So if you would calculate in today's money, it'd be $150 million. So Princess Diana had a wedding dress that had a 25-foot tail on the end of it. I think some people call that a train. I would call it a caboose. What do you think, Grayson? You've seen trails longer than that. Miles long, that's right. Trails longer than that, but can you imagine having a dress that trailed behind you that long? People would trip over it, wouldn't it? You would trip over it. You'd have to have people pick it up for you. Yeah, that would be crazy. Fortunately, none of the ladies in church this morning have dresses that go that far behind them. In January of this year, an Indian couple named Anant Ambani and Radhika Merchant got married, and they spent $600 million on everything around the wedding. And I can't imagine spending that much money on anything, much less a wedding. Do you know how many hot ham and cheese sandwiches they bought for that? Not many. Not many, no. I bet they didn't buy any. They probably bought other things. So they could have put up our church sanctuary and had a lot of money left over, couldn't they? So we're going to hear about a wedding today that went very badly. And you probably have never been to a wedding that went this badly, okay? So this wedding we're going to hear about today ended up with the groom marrying the wrong woman. he accidentally married this woman's sister. So anyway, that's kind of crazy, isn't it? Can you imagine getting up and marrying the wrong person? Well, see, back in those days, the women wore a big veil over their heads. Otherwise, you can't imagine. Like in our weddings, you could tell who you were marrying, right? Unless you were blind. I guess if you're blind. Blind people have to be pretty trusting. So Romans 15, verses 5 and 6 says, "May the God of endurance and encouragement grant you to live in such harmony with one another in accord with Christ Jesus, that together you may in one voice glorify the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ." So this verse isn't talking about marriage, but it is talking about people getting along with each other. And the important thing is not so much the wedding ceremony and all the things that happen around it. Some people focus a lot on that, but it's all this stuff that happens afterwards. And so it's important that when you marry somebody that you live with them in harmony for years and years. So a lot of times stories that we read about, like in fairy tales, they end with the wedding, right? So what happened after Cinderella and the prince got married? Well, nobody knows, right? But God tells us that the wedding is just the beginning. You know what happened? Okay. So it's far better to spend a little bit of money on a wedding and have a lot of love for God and each other than to spend millions of dollars on a wedding and be upset and angry all the time. Now, I hope none of you get married anytime soon. But when you do, you remember that it's about the love and not about the money you spend on the wedding. You can go back to your parents. So our story picks up with a penniless Jacob fleeing from the tent of his father and mother. He has clothes on his back, and that's about it. And there's been a time in the past where I preached on Bethel, and I started off, I think, talking about Jacob at Bethel. And I'm not planning to preach a whole lot about that this morning, but I do think it's helpful to summarize that story. So Jacob fell asleep near a town called Luz, or Luz. He had no pillow and no caravan of camels to go with him. He had only his cloak and used a pillow for a stone. Personally, I probably would rather just not have a pillow than use a stone for a pillow. But in doing a little research, it seems like humans have used soft pillows for the last 2,000 years. But prior to that, people like the Egyptians used hard pillows called headrests that were just designed to keep your head elevated while you were sleeping. I still think I would prefer nothing than a pillow made of stone. So that night, Jacob had a dream where he saw angels climbing and going down a stair or ladder and up it to heaven. And he heard God's voice repeating the blessing that was promised to Abraham and Isaac to him. So in response to this, Jacob did a few things. So he identified this place as a gateway to God and called it Beth-El, the house of God. Beth meaning house, El, a word for God. And this indicates that Jacob had the same idea as many people, that God is reached in specific places with specific rituals. In the Hebrew, Jacob says, "Venanoch la yadati." God was in this place, and I knew it not. And the rabbis interpreted this in different ways, but I really like one thing that I read that was written by Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. So I'm just going to read what he said, because I think it is just a different way of seeing this, and something that I was struck by it. So he says, sometimes it takes a great crisis to make us realize how self-centered we have been. And we can imagine Jacob was in just such a crisis here. He had nothing and he had lost everything because of his and his mother's conniving. The only question strong enough to endow existence with meaning is not, what do I need from life, but what does life need from me? That is the question we hear when we pray. More than an act of speaking, prayer is an act of listening to what God wants from us here, now. What we discover, if we are able to create that silence in the soul, is that we are not alone. We are here because someone, the one, wanted us to be, and he has set us a task only we can do. We emerge strengthened, transformed. More than prayer changes God, prayer changes us. It lets us see, feel, know that God is in this place. How do we reach that awareness? By moving beyond the first person singular, so that for a single moment, like Jacob, we can say, I know not the I. In the silence of the I, we meet the thou of God. And I think there is a lesson here for all of us, if we will but hear it. When there's too much of me, I am unlikely to connect with God. I read a very discouraging book about a lady who had a Christian background, and she'd had some discouraging events, and she spent most of this book talking about her pursuit of trying to find the goddess within herself. And that's the opposite of what we should be doing. Can you imagine an astronomer going outside at night to look at the stars and bringing with him a microscope? And yet that's what people do. They look inside themselves to find the things that are not there naturally. We learn to know God not by focusing on ourselves, but by focusing on our Creator and the creation around us that reveals just a little bit of that Creator. As John the Baptist said about Jesus, he must increase, but I must decrease. As I empty myself of myself, I am able to let him fill me more fully. So Jacob then poured out a little bit of olive oil on a rock that he'd used for his pillow, and this was his offering, his sacrifice. And then he made a deal with God. And we don't know God's response to this, but he said that if God would take care of him and bless him, then Jacob would give him a tenth of his income, and he would let God be his God. And I suppose Jacob didn't know what else to offer God, but it just feels a little silly. I was thinking about this, and it almost seems like Jacob is a man who comes to a millionaire, and he says, I will manage a store for you. And the man says, okay, what do you want? He says, well, I'll tell you what, I will manage the store for only 90% of the profit. And the guy says, wow, it's my store. Yes, but I'm managing it. That's not the kind of deal that just sounds like a great deal for God, does it? He's like, you know, I'll give you 10% of whatever I make if you bless me with it. Jacob didn't have anything here. And yet I think that's often our perspective when we come to God, is we think, you know, God, you are getting the real deal whenever I offer you what little I have. So Jacob left Bethel behind. We know that later on he returned here and offered sacrifices here. And Jacob was fleeing the land, hoping to find refuge, maybe a wife with his family in Haran, and leaving behind him a string of broken and damaged relationships. In the mid to late 1800s, there was an author by the name of Horatio Alger who wrote a series of children's books. These were not like Hardy Boy books, but they all were basically the same theme. They were books like Luke Larkin's Luck and Tattered Tom, and all of them started off with a boy who was down on his luck. His family was poor and destitute, living in poverty, and through hard work and honesty, he achieved great things. I read many of these books when I was a boy, and I don't know if they made a big impression on me, but I certainly enjoyed them. They were very formulaic. And there are many stories of real people who had very little, but because of hard work and perseverance, they ended up becoming millionaires. But this is not the story of Jacob. Jacob wanted that to be the case, but the Bible makes it clear that his success was because of the blessing of God. That's all. So I don't know that Jacob was ever super honest. Maybe he became that way towards the end of his life, but but God chose to bless him. So that's just an introduction. Jacob reaches Paddan Aram. And we're going to read from Genesis 29. We're going to read 30 verses here, and then we're going to discuss what is found in this. So Genesis 29. So Jacob went on his journey and came to the land of the people of the east. And he looked and saw a well in the field. And behold, there were three flocks of sheep lying by it. For out of that well they watered the flocks. A large stone was on the well's mouth. Now all the flocks would be gathered there, and they would roll the stone from the well's mouth, water the sheep, and put the stone back into its place on the well's mouth. And Jacob said to them, "My brethren, where are you from?" And they said, "We're from Haran." Then he said to them, "Do you know Laban, the son of Nahor?" And they said, "We know him." So he said to them, "Is he well?" And they said, "He is well. And look, here his daughter Rachel is coming with the sheep." Then he said, "Look, it is still high day. It is not time for the cattle to be gathered together. Water the sheep and go feed them." But they said, "We cannot until all the flocks are gathered together. And they have rolled the stone from the well's mouth. Then we water the sheep." Now while he was still speaking with them, Rachel came with her father's sheep, for she was a shepherdess. And it came to pass, when Jacob saw Rachel, the daughter of Laban, his mother's brother, and the sheep of Laban, his mother's brother, that Jacob went and rolled the stone from the well's mouth and watered the flock of Laban, his mother's brother. Then Jacob kissed Rachel and lifted up his voice and wept. And Jacob told Rachel that he was her father's relative and that he was Rebekah's son. So she ran and told her father. Then it came to pass, when Laban heard the report about Jacob, his sister's son, that he ran to meet him and embraced him and kissed him and brought him to his house. So he told Laban all these things. And Laban said to him, "Surely you are bone of my bone and you are my bone and my flesh. And he stayed with him for a month. Then Laban said to Jacob, "Because you are my relative, should you therefore serve me for nothing? Tell me, what should your wages be?" Now Laban had two daughters. The name of the elder was Leah, and the name of the younger was Rachel. Leah's eyes were delicate, but Rachel was beautiful of form and appearance. Now Jacob loved Rachel. So he said, "I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, your younger daughter." And Laban said, "It's better that I give you her to you than that I should give her to another man. Stay with me." So Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and they seemed only a few days to him because of the love he had for her. Then Jacob said to Laban, "Give me my wife, for my days are fulfilled, that I may go into her." And Laban gathered together all the men of the place and made a feast. Now it came to pass in the evening that he took Leah, to his daughter, and brought her to Jacob, and he went into her. And Laban gave his maid Zilpah to his daughter Leah as a maid. So it came to pass in the morning that, behold, it was Leah. And he said to Laban, "What have you done? What is this you have done to me? Was it not for Rachel that I served you? Why then have you deceived me?" And Laban said, "It must not be done so in our country to give the younger before the firstborn. Fulfill her a week, and we will give you this one also for the service which you will serve with me still another 7 years." Then Jacob did so and fulfilled her week. So he gave him his daughter Rachel as a wife also. And Laban gave his maid Bilhah to his daughter Rachel as a maid. And Jacob also went into Rachel, and he also loved Rachel more than Leah. And he served with Laban still another 7 years. So this story begins with a well. And there are a lot of stories in the Old Testament about wells. And we didn't talk about it, but Abraham dug a number of wells, and the men of Abimelech later filled them in. Isaac later redug them, and they became a point of contention between Abimelech and Isaac. Jacob's well in Sychar is around 75 feet deep and 7.5 feet across, and it was dug by hand. So we have to remember that digging a well is challenging. They didn't have big well diggers and drills and things like that. The men would have to dig through sand and limestone And they had no guarantee that they would reach water or that they would reach water before they ran out of energy. And certainly they didn't have any of these 100 or 200 foot wells that folks have around here. And out west, they have much deeper wells than that so they can get down into the aquifer. But in modern times, cities have sprung up along the edge of rivers or at train stops. In ancient times, cities needed to have water. So we visited Megiddo in Palestine, in Israel. And in that city, the northern kingdom of Israel took a spring of water and they covered it over and made a tunnel out to the water so that if somebody was trying to besiege the city, they would have city water inside the city, but the people outside the city would not be able to have water. So you can imagine if an army is traveling, they can bring with them a certain amount of food, but water is difficult. You can carry as much as you can carry in canteens or maybe barrels, but you don't have water for a lot of time. And so armies that were traveling would tend to make use of springs and rivers and things like that that were in local areas. But Israel is pretty dry, and so that would make it for a challenging situation if somebody was besieging a city and there was no spring or well outside of the city. And it makes you think here of Jesus' promise to the Samaritan at the well. So she was coming out to draw water, and he promised to give her living water. And she was confused as to the meaning of that and thought that this just meant that she wouldn't have to come to the well anymore. But I trust this morning that we understand that this living water is what we want to possess. So there were three flocks of sheep with their shepherds already there. Then there was a stone over the well that was only to be moved aside when all the flocks had gathered. And we don't know for sure why the stone was over the well. It makes a big deal about this stone. We can guess that maybe the stone was to keep the water from getting contaminated, so you wouldn't want just people dropping stuff in the well. Children walk by and they decide, oh, let's throw some stones in there and see how it sounds when the stone hits the water, and over time that fills up the well. Maybe it's just to keep children or livestock from falling into the well. And so Jacob comes up, and there's these flocks sitting there, and there's some shepherds with them, and he doesn't know exactly where he is. His GPS went on the blink a couple of oases ago, and so he sits down, and he starts to talk to them, and they tell him, yes, you're in Haran at last. He's pretty excited, and he says to them, do you know my uncle Laban? Well, sure they do. He's not only do they know him, he's well, he's healthy. And last of all, they mentioned, here comes his daughter Rachel with the sheep. So somehow Jacob has arrived at the right well at the right time, in time for the right person, so he thinks. And it seems like it's love at first sight. So this is one of the big situations in the Bible where people just fall in love, or at least Jacob did. We don't know so much about what Rachel thought. She's sort of an afterthought here, but a big deal is made here of Jacob single-handedly rolling the stone away from the well. So this is a stone that typically took a couple people at least to move, and here Jacob's impressing his cousin by picking up this stone and wrestling it away from the opening of the well. And I'm not sure why it is, but when a guy is interested in a girl, he wants to show himself to be very strong. So if when I was growing up in the youth group, if we were playing volleyball and somebody was interested in the girl, they would manage to make sure that they were standing beside her in volleyball, and then they would spike the ball as hard as they possibly could. Didn't really matter if it went inside the court, just so it just was really hard. And this was impressive. I think a lot of marriages were built over this spiking ability. Well, Jacob is impressing Rachel. He's strong. I was never that strong, so Elaine just had to deal. So Jacob didn't just pull the stone aside. He went ahead and watered Rebekah's flock. And I don't know if you see this, but this is the reverse of what happened when Abraham's servant met Rebekah. So Rebekah watered his camels, didn't she? And here Jacob is doing the reverse. And then Jacob, we see, is an emotional guy. So I can't imagine meeting a cousin of mine and bursting into tears. But of course, I never was interested in marrying my cousins either. But it describes Jacob introducing himself and weeping. He was excited at meeting Rachel. And maybe he was experiencing a lot of relief that his journey was over and that he'd arrived safely. And now we meet Laban. So at the beginning, he seems like a great guy. He introduces himself, hugs Jacob, says he can clearly recognize that Jacob is his relative. He just can see it in his flesh and bone. So I guess he had X-ray vision. So more than that, when Jacob had been there for a little while, Laban pretty much told him that he thought he should get paid for the work he was doing around the place. And so here Jacob made his move. He asked Laban for his daughter, Rachel. And this is where we discover that Rachel wasn't the only daughter. There were two daughters. One was named Leah, and one was named Rachel. So it says that Leah had delicate eyes, and it seems likely that this was in contrast to Rachel, so Jacob just wasn't attracted to Leah. She was fine, but there was something a little funny about her eyes, and maybe they just weren't strong. But we don't know what kind of a bargain was made here, but we see the conclusion. Laban asked for 7 years' labor of Jacob. This would have been the equivalent of about 130 shekels of value. If you look in the book of Deuteronomy, it sets the bride price at 50 shekels. So this was almost three times the normal value that would be put upon a bride. And perhaps this is the first clue that we have that Laban was money grubbing. And then the comment is made that although 7 years is a long time, Jacob loved Rachel so much that it seemed just a few days to him. So Jacob acted as a shepherd. And it's not as though Jacob showed up at Haran with a whole bunch of skills. He wasn't an accountant. He didn't have a degree in astrophysics or the ability to doctor all the people around. He could shepherd sheep. That was what he could do. I was reading about Ingvar Kamprad. He was born in Sweden in 1926. Does anybody know who he was? Yeah. So as a five-year-old boy, he went door to door in his neighborhood and sold matchsticks to people. It doesn't seem like, I wouldn't buy matchsticks for my neighbor children. But anyway, somehow he did this. And as time went by, he got old enough to ride a bicycle and sell random things, everything from seeds to Christmas cards. And it turned out that he had a business-type mind. He developed his relationships with people. And at the age of 17, he founded a company to sell a variety of items to people. And he called the company IKEA. And eventually became one of the biggest furniture companies in the world. And so clearly Ingvar was somebody who had a talent. And he developed that talent. And he got better at it. And he progressed. But this is the opposite of what we see with Jacob. Jacob didn't develop anything. So years later, he's over 100 years old, and he's going into Egypt, and Pharaoh asks him about what he does. And he says this. So Joseph went and told Pharaoh, "My father and brothers with their flocks and herds and everything they own have come from the land of Canaan and are now in Goshen." He chose five of his brothers and presented them before Pharaoh. Pharaoh asked his brothers, "What is your occupation?" "Your servants are shepherds," they replied to Pharaoh, "just as our fathers were." So at the end of 20 years in Haran, Jacob was a little better shepherd than at the beginning, but he was still just a shepherd. And more than anything, for the first 14 years in Haran, he didn't earn anything except his wives, and I guess their servants. So we come to the great bride switch. So this is one of the dirtiest tricks in Scripture. It certainly would never have happened at a Mennonite wedding. The how is explained that it was dark, Leah was veiled, and probably Jacob was drinking alcoholic beverages. So it wasn't until the following morning they figured things out and it was too late. The why is less clear. We have Laban's comment that in their culture, the older daughter is always married first. I don't think that's a full explanation. And at best, it's a rationalization for Laban's bad behavior. I think more than this, we have to assume that there weren't any prospects for marrying Leah off. So Laban wasn't going to get a lot of money for Leah. So in that culture, there was a bride price that you paid, and Rachel commanded a big bride price, and Laban wasn't going to get that for Leah. Because we know that for this deception to work, Leah had to be in on it. If she spoke or gave herself away, Jacob would have known, and she didn't. Now, from Laban's standpoint, it was an opportunity to get another 7 years of work out of Jacob for free. Jacob had been basically working as a slave for 7 years already. But it's also impossible not to look at this situation as a mirror to Jacob's stealing of his brother's blessing. This trick worked because of the darkness of night and Jacob's relative blindness because of it, in the same way that his trick on Isaac had worked because of his blindness. Jacob may not have realized up till this point, but he had met a bigger deceiver than himself. So Laban's solution was that Jacob could get married another week later to the younger sister. In return, all Jacob had to do was commit himself to working another 7 years. So I don't suppose that Jacob felt like he had much choice in this situation. He was pretty desperate. Laban had him over the barrel, and this solution only made Laban happy. Jacob was frustrated. He ended up with two wives and two concubines where he only really wanted one wife. Leah wasn't happy because she felt unloved. The passage actually says hated by Jacob. And Rachel wasn't happy because she was now the second wife. And as time went by, she discovered that she had difficulty having children, whereas Leah bore Jacob six sons. So let's go on to some lessons from this story. So the first thing I want to note is that Jacob did not end up having any better experience with the people of Paddan Aram compared to the people of Canaan. So I think many people around this world are convinced that the problems that they're facing today are because they have the wrong people in their lives, or that they are in the wrong location or the wrong church. Ralph Moody wrote a story called The Horse of a Different Color, and in this particular situation, Ralph was with a railroad station manager, and there was a man with his family sitting at the railroad station. "How are the folks around here?" the man asked the station manager. "How were they where you came from?" the manager asked. The man proceeded to tell him about how terrible the people were. They were no good, good for nothing. They were deceptive, mean, untrustworthy. The man ran on for about 5 minutes, telling about how terrible these people were. When he finally ran down, the station manager said simply, "I think you'll find them about the same round here." Jacob could have told you everything that was wrong with his prospects in Canaan. His father was passive and useless. His brother was just plain stupid, and the only person worth knowing there was his mother. When he arrived in Haran, everything was wonderful. His cousin was beautiful. His uncle was welcoming and willing to reward his hard work. He didn't have much, but his prospects were excellent. And after 7 years of hard work, it turned out that it was no better at all. His uncle wasn't the kind person that he seemed in the beginning. He had worked for 7 years for the wrong wife, and he still had no money or prospects. And the point I would bring out here is that if we think that our lives are going to be changed by moving to a different job, location, or church, we are often deluded. Now, I'm not going to say that God doesn't call us to do something different. There are many times where he does. But if I, as a doctor, go to another location, I think, you know, things are too hard at my office. I did this. I was in Indiana, and I moved to Brookneal. And you know what I discovered? I'm the same kind of person in Brookneal that I was in Indiana. I'm not a whole lot different. So the same challenges that I face with finishing up charting and taking care of referrals and feeling overwhelmed when I take care of patients, I face in Brookneal. And I would face them in Anchorage, Alaska, or El Paso, Texas. It doesn't matter how far north or south of the equator go. I'm really the same person. And this doesn't mean, as I said, that God doesn't call us to different places. He certainly does. But we shouldn't expect that everything is going to be perfect just because we change a position. Second thing is that the law of sowing and reaping holds true. Galatians 6, verses 7 and through 9 says, "Be not deceived, God is not mocked, for whatever a man sows, that he will also reap. For he who sows to his flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap life, everlasting life. And let us not grow weary while doing good, for in due season we shall reap if we do not lose heart." So Jacob had clearly sowed deception in his relationship with his brother and father. And it seemed like the price that he paid was simply having to flee from Canaan. But it was more than that. So laws of sowing and reaping are clear from farming. You reap in what kind you sow. So if you sow sunflowers, you don't reap thistles. And if you sow thistles, you don't reap sweet potatoes. You reap at a different time later than you sow. So the seed that you put in the ground at the end of April or the beginning of May will not be ready for harvest until July, sometimes much later than that. And you reap more than you sow. Farmers would give up if they planted a bushel of soybeans and got a bushel back. The amount of seed is comparatively small compared to the quantity of the harvest. And in the case of Jacob, he sowed deception and he reaped deception in his relationship with Laban. The Apostle Paul was speaking specifically of things we should invest ourselves in. We should sow to the Spirit. And he finishes by an encouragement not to lose heart, even though the time between planting and harvest is long. So God puts the people in our paths that we need, not the ones that we want. So Jacob needed a relationship with somebody like Laban. And I don't know why there wasn't an easier way for Jacob to learn, but there wasn't. And we have talked about the fact that it probably wasn't fun to do business with Jacob because he was always looking for an advantage. It was worse doing business with Laban. When Laban looked at his daughters, he looked at how much he could get out of marrying them off. And that's a terrible thing to think about. If I thought about that as my daughters, I don't think anybody's going to pay me to marry my daughters. But even if they would, I value them for who they are, not because they're worth something to me. Later on, we find that Jacob was constantly upset with Laban for constantly changing his wages. So God puts people in our lives for a variety of reasons. Maybe he wants us to learn something from them. Maybe they are needed to help or encourage us. Maybe we are supposed to encourage them. But I think it's important to remember that God uses bad people in our lives too. So King Nebuchadnezzar was an instrument of God. We read that in Jeremiah 27, 1 through 11, that God was using King Nebuchadnezzar to punish the people. So, too many men put more effort into courting their wives than into making them feel loved after they're married. And we're going to get into this more next time, but if you save up for something and you get it, something you really want, that is not the end of it. So you get a new truck home and you never change the oil in it and you never do anything to keep it up. It's not going to last long, will it? And a marriage is no different. You spend $600 million on your wedding. The question is, what are you going to do to make certain that that marriage lasts? And there's certain things that men and women can do, investing themselves in it, maintaining it, showing love to the person they're married to, that in the busyness of everyday life, we don't always do. And that's sad. I don't think Jacob always did that. And we're going to talk about that a little bit more next time. God bless Jacob. So for all of Jacob and Laban's conniving, the blessing that came to both Jacob and Laban came because of God. So does God help those who help themselves? The answer is that God blesses those who have devoted themselves wholly to serving him. He blesses them in a lot more ways than simply giving them a bunch of material things. If you believe that the reason to serve God is so that you can get a big house, a nice vehicle, and a special parking space at your workplace, then you are confused as the reason to serve God. And more than that, you're confused as to who God is. More often than not, when we try to help ourselves, we get into trouble. And kind of a final thing just to mention is that Jacob wasn't making a serious effort to serve God. So at the episode at Bethel, Jacob promised God that God could be his God, and in return he would tithe some of his money to God. And it seemed like Jacob had the same concept of a relationship with God that the people around him had with respect to their idols. Much of the heartbreak in Jacob's life could have been averted by Jacob spending more time getting to know God, listening to his voice, and pursuing a relationship with him in a way that he just doesn't seem to have desired, at least not yet. So as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about Jacob and ourselves as clay and about how God molds us. And these stories are about how Jacob became somebody who was worthy of respect. To this point, we don't see a whole lot of wonderful stuff. They're interesting stories, but they're certainly not things that make you think, you know, Jacob was a wonderful person. In 1854, Johannes Brahms began to compose his first symphony. He made extensive sketches and tried to bring the piece to a place where he could share it with a public audience. Brahms continued to work on the symphony for the next 20 years. It wasn't until 1876 that his symphony was finally performed. The people who heard this symphony loved it. Some even called it Beethoven's 10th symphony, believing that Brahms had inherited the mantle of an earlier titan of the composing world. And taking time to make certain that everything is right is good. There are plenty of composers who whipped out pieces of music in short periods of time, and others took much longer to prepare their work. But I think the wonderful thing is that God takes decades to help each one of us mature. He works in our hearts and our lives. It isn't just time, but hard experiences and hard people around us that impact us. Often these hard experiences teach us more about ourselves than they do about other people. The qualities that we think make us a good leader are the same ones that totally aggravate us in somebody else. Jacob was fine treating Esau and Isaac deceptively, but I'm guessing it didn't feel so good when Laban deceived him. Jeremiah 18:1 through 4, the word which came to Jeremiah from the Lord saying, "Arise and go down to the potter's house, and there I will cause you to hear my words." Then I went down to the potter's house, and there he was, the potter that is, making something at the wheel. And the vessel that he made of clay was marred in the hands of the potter. So he made it again into another vessel, as it seemed good to the potter to make. So how many years did it take God, the master potter, to mold Jacob into someone who is worthwhile? How many years will it take God to mold you into a vessel that is worthy of being in his house? The process isn't going to be easy. Maybe it'd be easier if we were more compliant clay. Maybe it'd be easier if we listened better. But the blessing is that God doesn't give up. The clay in this passage of Jeremiah was marred. It had serious flaws in it. But the potter didn't pitch the clay. He just kept going, pulled the flaw out, worked with it until there was something that he could use. And we need to understand that this is true in our own lives as well. God will put the people in our path that we need to grow. He will bring us through hard valleys and up mountaintops so that in the end, we can be more and more like Jesus.